The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazines. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from teenvogue.com and kidspiritonline.com. Our first article today from teenvogue.com. The DARE program tried to reshape the image of police officers in the United States. This article was written by Max Felker Cantor on April 4th. If you ask someone who went to elementary school in the 1980s or 1990s about the DARE program, they'll likely have a story for you. Many recall the DARE program, which stands for Drug Abuse Resistance Education, as an ineffective course that did more to introduce them to drugs than anything else. They might remember making fun of their DARE officer or watching episodes about the drug education classes in their favorite sitcoms. In its heyday, DARE was serious business. It was the largest and most visible drug prevention program in the United States. At its height, police officers taught DARE to 5th and 6th grade students in more than 75% of American school districts, as well as in dozens of countries around the world. Alongside the students receiving the full 17-week curriculum, millions of other students ranging from kindergarten to high school received variations of DARE. By the end of the 1990s, DARE had reached an estimated 50 million students globally. While DARE is not what it used to be in the 1980s and 1990s, it's still around, celebrating its 40th anniversary last year. Some schools continue to graduate DARE classes, while others have adopted or restarted defunct programs. DARE America, the nonprofit organization that oversees the program, continues to report millions of dollars in revenue and expenses. Officials continue to promote the use of police as credible experts and reliable instructors in school classrooms. DARE to Say No, Policing and the War on Drugs in Schools is the first full history of the DARE program. It traces DARE's rapid growth from Los Angeles to schools across the country and how, through savvy marketing and public relations, DARE became a cultural icon and symbol of the drug war. More centrally, it shows how the police used DARE as a legitimization tactic, empowering officers to enter children's lives as teachers, friends, and mentors. A closer look at this history reveals that DARE was never solely about drug education, but fundamentally about the expansion of police power and authority in America. The most important part of the program was the DARE officer. To legitimize the use of uniformed police officers as teachers, DARE officers would teach kids self-esteem, resistance to peer pressure, and how to say no to drugs. In the minds of DARE's proponents, enlisting police as teachers would turn officers into friends and mentors. Yet, as law enforcement representatives who taught in their police uniforms, DARE officers connected the drug war's soft side of prevention with its hard side of aggressive enforcement of drug laws. DARE's police school partnership intended to reimagine the role of the police officer far more than it prevented drug use. While health and education specialists actually had experts in substance use prevention, both LAPD and LAUSD officials believed that using officers as teachers would provide many essential components of the program, including a staff which is recognized by the students as experts in the field of substance abuse, opportunity for officers to relate with students, parents, and teachers in a non-enforcement role, and most importantly, trust between the school community and the officers based on familiarity. They envisioned the DARE officer would change youth perception of the police by creating a non-punitive relationship between officers and kids. DARE officers give a different face of law enforcement. DARE America Executive Director and former LAPD Deputy Chief Glenn Levant explained, "A child's first experience with a uniformed officer is in a friendly, helpful way. You have to have programs like DARE in place so police aren't viewed as an occupying army." From the vantage point of the DARE officer, DARE was a not-so-subtle propaganda campaign to reshape the image of the police. While police departments had long attempted to use community relations and youth programs to push kids to identify with the police, DARE represented a shift from earlier community-oriented policing strategies. It attempted to burnish the image of the police within the context of an aggressive drug and gang war that actively undermined trust in the police. Students in the program were implicitly taught to identify with and respect police officers through DARE officers' participation in a wide range of extracurricular activities. During the pilot year, for instance, one officer coached a DARE track club, while another coached a football team. Several officers were even involved in holiday activities at the school, including playing Santa Claus and Rudolph, clearly not roles in which young people are used to seeing law enforcement officers. Crucially, the officers believed that this sort of activity was a central part of DARE's mission. The officers feel that these extra activities and involvements are very beneficial to furthering the goals of Project DARE, an interim evaluation report concluded. The most useful part of the program, according to officers, was how students shifted their attitudes and perceptions of the police as someone to be trusted, not feared. However, the aspect of the project which brought the most satisfaction to the officers was working with the children and having the children come to accept and confide in them. The implicit goal of changing the image of police officers was part of the program's origins. When the LAPD and LAUSD submitted a grant proposal for second-year funding, for example, they allocated resources to buy officers' athletic uniforms. Part of the DARE method is to involve the officers in the total school program, the LAPD and LAUSD grant writers emphasized. Naturally, this includes school athletic events. The officers wear their uniforms for all other school events, but they cannot be worn for athletics. Athletic uniforms serve to remind students, spectators, and parents of the officers' purpose and provide inexpensive yet effective program identity. Such an orientation was meant to create a more positive image of police officers than aggressive crime fighters, which became a selling point of the program. In addition to their formal classroom teaching, a 1988 Department of Justice DARE manual explained, DARE officers spend time on the playground, in the cafeteria, and at student assemblies to interact with students informally. In this way, students have an opportunity to become acquainted with the officer as a trusted friend who is interested in their happiness and welfare. Adding to this effort, law enforcement agencies created collectible trading cards of DARE officers to both promote the program and further humanize the police. Many students seemed to adore their DARE officers. Photographs showed smiling students with their DARE officers, both inside and outside the classroom. Oftentimes, they wrote about their experiences with officers in their DARE essays, which were sometimes published in newspapers across the country. As one Ohio student wrote after completing DARE in 2000, Dare means a lot to me. I like seeing my Dare officer's happy, smiling face every Wednesday. I think Dare is a really good program. It has taught me what to do and what not to do to protect myself from danger. I think Dare has helped provide a good, clear image in my mind if I do something bad. I have learned not to do drugs, get into gangs, or smoke. Thank you, Captain Stanley. 75 students in Sioux City, Iowa, variously wrote, I believe DARE helped people think of themselves as special. Whenever I see my plaque or wear my t-shirt, I think of all the great and fun times I had in DARE. And this year when I was told that we would be having DARE, I figured that it would be some officer coming into our classroom and just saying, don't do drugs, over and over again. Actually, it was great. Student perceptions of DARE usually expressed a standard essay form about the program and praise for the DARE officer, and they were all positive, of course. Other students took the message to heart and elevated their DARE enthusiasm to another level. 5 students from San Bernardino, for example, performed a skit for their DARE graduation based on anti-drug lyrics and popular music. The San Bernardino Police Department, after learning about the group, asked the students to perform their skit at a DARE convention in August 1987. The group became known as the DARE Squad, a group of 5 kids who sang songs against drugs. The students also wrote and produced a monthly student newsletter called DARE Squad Speaks, with many articles about DARE, the DARE Bear, and other anti-drug initiatives, such as Red Ribbon Week. For other students, the DARE experience did not end when they left elementary school. In some instances, high school students who had completed DARE came back as DARE role models. As one Kentucky DARE officer noted, as part of the DARE curriculum, we have a role model class, using drug and alcohol-free students from our high schools. The students talk to the elementary kids, telling them that they can be drug-free and accepted, even admired, by their peers because of their choice. The DARE role models talked to kids about not using drugs or alcohol and the high school experience. For DARE officers, the program was another metric of success. The students chosen did an excellent job for me, the Kentucky DARE officer continued, and the kids really enjoyed having them in the classroom. Sometimes, however, the message students took away from DARE had less to do with avoiding drugs and more to do with critiques of the program. Many students enjoyed the role-playing activities and skits, not because they were interested in the anti-drug messaging or content, but because they enjoyed getting in front of the class and acting as a drug dealer or buyer. One student from Columbus, Ohio, recalled how they tried to make their friends laugh during skits in which they would sag their pants, wear bandanas, and act like drug dealers they had seen in movies or on television. Or, more explicitly, some saw DARE as an escape from academic work. One student in Kentucky wrote, "Our DARE officer is Officer Holt. In DARE, we do lots of fun things, and we never have any tests. Near the end of DARE, when we were getting ready for graduation, we missed almost 2 weeks of school." Many children enjoyed DARE because it let them connect with fellow students, make friends laugh, or avoid regular classwork, not for its anti-drug messaging or content. Some of the students who questioned the program were slightly more biting in their critiques. Students in Wausau, Wisconsin, for instance, debated to the editorial pages of the Rib Mountain Gazette, a student newspaper. While the DARE proponents reiterated similar arguments about the importance of learning how to say no to drugs and resisting peer pressure, Charlie Hughes and Eric Rajek had a different take, to put it mildly. DARE is useless, they argued, because drugs are not a major problem in this area. In Los Angeles, yes. Rib Mountain, no. They also pointed out that DARE took away 50 minutes of our social studies time, which in total adds up to 900 minutes a semester. But in a more direct challenge to DARE's entire philosophy, they summed up their argument, stating, "Finally, we believe that if this has to be taught, it should be taught by a teacher, not a police officer." DARE was never solely a drug prevention program. As many law enforcement officers believed, the real value and goal of DARE was as much about integrating police into schools and as part of the broader community. The long-staying power of DARE in American society and culture, even if through parody and irony, spoke less to the efficacy of the program than to the ways the program had attempted to shape the image of the police and enable cops to infiltrate schools. And there is a note. From DARE to Say No, Policing and the War on Drugs in Schools by Max Felker Cantor. Copyright 2024 by Max Felker Cantor. Used by permission of the University of North Carolina Press. Our next article from KidSpiritOnline.com. Change and Crisis, a Symbiotic Relationship. This article was written by Aza Afridi on March 3rd. Does a crisis cause change, or does change cause crisis? While the concept of change is not unique to our generation, the speed and nature of change is unprecedented. Whether it is technology, considering the sheer pace of development of AI, climate, or health sciences, humanity is changing faster and faster at the same time as the world we live in. This can be described as VUCA, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. It is no wonder that most of us conflate crisis and change as two sides of the same coin. It is true that a crisis is often a catalyst for change, good or bad. A health crisis, for example, can sometimes permanently alter one's life for the worse. On the other hand, the Internet has changed the way we work for the better. Think of Zoom and Google. The Great Depression led to fundamental changes in the financial system that led to decades of economic prosperity, and the Civil Rights Movement led to the end of segregation. As Paul Romer said, "A crisis is a terrible thing to waste." Conversely, significant change can also lead to a crisis. With the advent of AI, there is fear of mass unemployment in the future. A rapidly changing environment is leading to extreme climates that are causing human catastrophes with each passing season. Winning the lottery, a seemingly happy change of circumstances, can cause a crisis of personality and lead to gambling and other destructive habits. Even simple natural changes, such as puberty and moving from middle school to high school, is often a precursor to anxiety about personal body shapes, social relationships, and academic prowess. Heraclitus, an ancient Greek philosopher, saw change as the fundamental nature of the universe. His philosophy suggests that change is constant and inevitable, likening life to a river where one never steps in the same water twice. In his view, a crisis could be seen as a moment when the river's flow becomes turbulent, prompting adaptation and transformation until the next bend in the river. That crisis leads to change, which leads to crisis, is also implied by Aristotle's notion of potential and actuality. He argued that everything has the potential to become something else. Change, according to Aristotle, occurs when the potential of something becomes actualized. In the context of crises, they serve as catalysts where latent potentials are realized by giving birth to change. However, the notion of a linear cause-effect relationship between crisis and change might be an oversimplification. Instead, they may be parallel streams, to borrow from the imagery of Heraclitus, converging intermittently, influencing each other in intricate and unpredictable ways. Change doesn't always arise from crises. However, it emerges from deliberate choices, visionary leadership, or collective aspirations. Learning a new language or skill is a form of change, yet not associated with any crisis. Similarly, many advancements in communication or transport, e.g., the cell phone or airplanes, are not because humanity was facing a crisis, but rather a result of human innovation. Some changes are incremental. They happen gradually over time without being directly linked to a crisis. Societal shifts, such as changing attitudes toward certain social issues, often evolve slowly through education, advocacy, and generational shifts. These changes don't always result from a single crisis, but are the culmination of multiple influences over time. Similarly, crises can occur without directly causing significant change afterward. For example, a natural disaster, tornado or earthquake, may hit a region causing damage. However, the subsequent recovery is aimed to restore life as it was before without any major modifications. In fact, as humans, we try very hard to restore rather than change original structures. Similarly, health epidemics in stable settings don't lead to or are caused by any significant change. A new virus emerges and is eventually eliminated without any drastic change to the underlying healthcare system. COVID-19 is a recent example. In the world of finance, for example, market crashes emerge due to computer glitches or speculation. But if the existing systems cater to the crash, no fundamental change in regulations or practices takes place. Crises might prompt temporary adjustments without leading to lasting change. For example, during a temporary fuel shortage, individuals might adjust their transportation habits. But once the crisis is resolved, they may revert to their previous behaviors without instituting lasting changes. Many societies and governments try their best to maintain the status quo, even in the face of economic or social crisis. The Arab Spring suggests a change in the status quo, yet subsequent years have shown a reversion to similar forms of government in that region. These examples demonstrate that crises can occur independently of preceding changes and might not always result in substantial changes afterward. While some crises prompt adaptations or short-term adjustments, they don't always lead to transformative shifts in systems or societal structures, showcasing a separation between crises and the consequential changes that follow. A useful lens to summarize this conundrum can be that change is a broader concept encompassing various transformations, while a crisis typically refers to a specific, often challenging event or period that disrupts the norm. They can intersect, but aren't mutually dependent. Understanding this independence can help navigate and respond to both change and crisis more effectively. Change can prompt adaptation and innovation, leading to progress and improvement. Crisis, however, demands immediate attention and often requires managing unexpected or adverse circumstances without necessarily resulting in long-term change. People can adapt to changes without going through a crisis or use a crisis as a catalyst for change. My own perspective is best articulated by the author Alvin Toffler. Change is not merely necessary to life, it is life. As a teenager, I would find life boring to the verge of being pointless unless there wasn't continual change to look forward to. From graduating each year to a more advanced grade, to being exposed to marginalized children at a refugee camp during a summer internship, change is a constant. However, some of this change comes in the form of a short-term crisis, From finding the right prom dress to my computer crashing during the SAT test. Gulp. In the same vein, Toffler's perspective emphasizes the inherent nature of change as an essential aspect of existence. This idea suggests that change itself is not contingent on crises. Instead, it is a fundamental characteristic of life, while crises are sporadic moments during life that we need to face with resilience. I cannot wait to wake up to what change tomorrow will bring. And our next article from TeenVogue.com. Olivia Rodrigo surprises sold-out Madison Square Garden crowd with Noah Kahan Stick Season duet. This article was written by Angie Jamie on April 6th. Olivia Rodrigo is manifesting her dreams and making them a reality. Joining the Vampire Singers sold-out concert at Madison Square Garden in New York City on April 5th, Noah Kahan hit the stage to perform a duet of Stick Season with Rodrigo. The performance comes just months after Rodrigo told Variety at the Governor's Awards in Hollywood that she was putting her love for Noah Kahan out there in the universe. She added, "I think he's so great, and he's very inspiring," she said, with fingers crossed. "One of these days." Stick Season at Madison Square Garden, smiley face emoji. At Noah Kahan Music is the greatest of all time. Rodrigo captioned with a video posted to Instagram on Saturday morning following the show. Kahan showed love in the comments, writing, "Better than the original. Olivia, you're a star. Best show I've ever seen." Back in October, Kahan gushed in a TikTok duet of Rodrigo's performance. Vibing to footage of her cover, he wrote, "Olivia covering Stick Season? Her song now. I'd give her my entire discography," the folk singer joked in the caption. "Olivia, thank you so much." The match made in folk singer heaven will continue this Record Store Day, April 20th. Olivia Rodrigo and Noah Kahan are set to release a special edition split single on vinyl featuring Rodrigo's cover of Kahan's Stick Season on the A side, together with Kahan's cover of Rodrigo's Lacey on the B side. Tracks will feature recordings from both artists during respective appearances on BBC Radio 1's Live Lounge last year. Rodrigo's Guts tour will continue at venues around the world all summer long. We've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.